The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Keith Stewart, games editor at The Guardian, and this is a special games takeover of Tech Weekly. So this week we'll be asking why so many AAA releases arrive with that one feature that no one wants: game-breaking bugs.
This game has been out for 2.5 months. They've done all. They need to sort this out. Let me know what issues you've had. Let me know if you agree with what I've said, because it's fucking ridiculous.
We'll also be discussing artificial intelligence and procedural generation. What are they, and why are they about to change games forever? And we'll be talking to one of the creators of That Dragon Cancer, an immensely moving game born out of a real-life struggle with the disease. Stay tuned. This is a games-friendly edition of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. This week, I'm joined by an esteemed panel of video game experts, and I'm going to get them to introduce themselves, starting with you, Michael.
I'm Michael Cook. I'm a research associate at Goldsmiths at the University of London, and I do research into automated game design and all sorts of things related to it.
I'm Harvey Elliott. I'm Chief Executive Officer of Marmalade Technologies, which is a cross-platform SDK for people developing games in the mobile space, a game studio. I also chair the BAFTA Games Committee, BAFTA Children's Committee, and spent many, many years at Electronic Arts.
And I'm Philippa Waugh. I'm a journalist over at Rock, Paper, Shotgun.
And Philippa's going to be helping me to interrogate and intimidate our guests today, I think, in the usual Rock, Paper, Shotgun style. First up, last week, Ubisoft released the latest title in its multi-million-selling Assassin's Creed series, bringing the historical action to revolutionary Paris. But instead of liberty, egality, and fraternity, many purchasers have encountered calamity, adversity, and hilarity thanks to a range of game-breaking bugs, including characters disappearing into floors or materialising in fireplaces. It's far from an isolated incident, so why do big-budget video games made by teams of many hundreds sometimes get released in a seemingly incomplete form? Harvey... I've basically got you here almost as a kind of representative of mainstream development with your 20 years experience, or many years experience in games.
Yeah, it's over 20. The grey hair is real.
So that was probably just after a year there at EA.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I agree with that.
So can you tell us from an industry standpoint why this does happen so much? Why we often get to a day one release of a video game and there are lots of problems still kind of in the game's code?
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of talking generally first, rather than looking specifically at Assassin's Creed, you know, the effort that goes into any game is staggeringly huge, no matter what, you know, whether it's a small mobile title or a massive console experience. What we do find is the bigger the game, the more room there is for errors to creep in. Matching any big development budget is a huge test effort and a QA team that are vigorously testing every bug. And what I found at EA is we actually had a sort of a triple check process. So the game team really cared about getting their game quality as high as it could be, making sure the bugs have been ironed out and fixed. The QA team's job would be then to go break it, go figure out all the things that are broken. And then on the back of that, we had a certification group that tested the whole game again with fresh eyes, who were determined to prove QA wrong, that they hadn't found all the bugs. And that created this sort of, well, responsibility on the dev team. You didn't want to get messed up by your QA guys. Responsibility on the QA guys, who didn't want to get failed by the certification guys. And then certification guys send it off to first party, who then do their own internal tests. Only if you clear all of those would you then get your game out to market. And then even after you do all that rigorous testing, there are always bugs and things that you didn't expect. Because, you know, even in that world of that development team QA certification groups, you still only have a couple hundred people looking at a game. And as soon as you go to market, you're talking about hundreds of thousands or millions of people looking at games. And those bugs are so much harder to find because you don't know what every player is going to do in every circumstance. Now, the bugs in Assassin's Creed are a little bit more evident, right? There are a few things that are happening quite visually to a lot of people. I don't know why those weren't caught. I imagine there have been some changes made right towards the end of development, which haven't had as much testing as they would perhaps normally like, or have had the testing, but there's a circumstance that they couldn't find during that initial testing when it was just a few hundred people playing it through, and then you're getting up to thousands, millions of people playing it, and suddenly the bugs seem so prevalent. Mm-hmm. And just to reference the Bendgate issue with the iPhone, you know, we're talking about a handful of people, but in the community of millions of people, iPhones are bending. Oh my goodness, it's a bending thing. Now, in the world of Assassin's Creed, maybe it's not hundreds and thousands of people, but there are a lot of people who are finding an issue that is getting reported, and that becomes a bigger item in itself. But I would say on behalf of the entire games industry, which you've given me a little bit of responsibility over, no game leaves untested. No game gets through all of those certification processes without a vigorous QA process. Someone somewhere may have missed something, but there is no lack of effort, budget, spend on making sure that the games are as rigorously tested as possible, because that's ultimately what, you know, every publisher, every developer holds their name by the product they put out. And these games, we're talking about, you know, massive multi-million dollar budgets where people expect a game of a very high standard, and the team know that, and that's their representation, and you're only ever as good as the last game you ship. So they would have felt personally quite responsible for it.
Do you think partly it's also to do with the fact that games are so much more? I mean, we've started really to talk about games as services rather than products, because in the 10 years ago, if you made a game, you released it, and that was it. Your responsibility over that product ended. But nowadays, video games are so much more complicated. They have very complicated online and multiplayer elements, but also there are systems which kind of require you to be checking in online all the time. So, and games are just enormous now. I mean, Assassin's Creed effectively takes place in a scaled depiction of revolutionary France, and we've seen with Bethesda with their games like Fallout 3 and the Elder Scrolls titles. Again, there are lots of bugs there simply because the game is so enormous. So do you think it's almost that the ambition of games is making it harder to catch those bugs?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the games, and certainly on console games, we're seeing a huge scale in the depth of experience and the complexity of it. But I think there's a lot of maturity in the technology we use to build those games in the first place. So I would expect us to be more capable of building those bigger experiences as an industry, on behalf of the entire industry. I would expect us to be more capable of building systems that can scale more efficiently and more productively with those sorts of experiences. And, you know, typically bugs creep in because you rush something at the last minute, because you didn't anticipate a specific play style that was going to happen. There is a cascade effect where you change one area of code and something else changes on the other side of your code base and you don't notice it. And, you know, you're right, there's a world where we're now constantly updating and constantly changing and constantly moving our games on. Some of that's done through server changes, so it doesn't even require you to download an update. We've made some change somewhere to an AI system or a tweak. But there can be knock-ons, and that's the most dangerous part of bug fixing or game development, is you fix one thing in one area, it can create an unintended circumstance somewhere else, which is hard to keep testing and on top of. And the more updates you do, the more risks you're introducing to the game. So there are always those sort of dangers to play with.
Do you think you obviously work mostly in the smartphone space now with Marmalade. You've created a kind of cross-platform engine for games development. Do you think there's lessons that the console industry can learn from the smartphone industry in terms of how to deal with gamers and problems after release, because smartphone games are essentially based on the sort of premise of iteration, aren't they? A game comes out, but it's always kind of in a beta state, and people will be watched how the developers will watch how gamers play and will iterate accordingly and change the code. So do you think there's lessons from the smartphone sector that could be applied to consoles?
Yeah, actually, I see lessons going both ways, because what I've never lost sight of is the ambition you have with a console game. When you've got a larger budget or a larger team, that you have an ambition that you are almost afraid of having with a mobile game, which is wrong, because ultimately people's play experience, and when you get to people out there in the public, including myself as a games player, I'm not so discerning now between playing on a console or playing on a mobile. I'm just playing a game and I'm putting my time in. And the most dangerous button on any mobile phone is the home button or the lock button or the just close this damn app and get me out of it button. And that's so instantaneous, and your next app experience is so instantaneous on that it's very easy to churn through. So what we actually find on mobile is you have to make sure your product isn't buggy. You can change and tweak a lot of stuff on the fly, and we actually, what I think is most beneficial from the world of mobile is the amount of telemetry you can read in and the way you can react to it on a server side to adjust the gameplay for people as they're playing their game. And I think having that live link and that live connection is very dangerous, so you have to have a very robust sort of process for how you operate it, but it's also very rewarding, where you can look at play patterns and make sure players don't get blocked and move them on in the right way and give them hints and help and guidance. And that sort of world didn't really exist, as you said earlier, it didn't exist in console before. We shipped the product, a month and a half later it came out. I mean, that was life. And now we're constantly changing and updating and moving our games on, and it happens a lot in mobile, and it's happening more and more on console.
Philippa, I sometimes think maybe us as gamers are kind of semi-responsible for what's happening with games at the moment. If you look at like Assassin's Creed and Grand Theft Auto, they're enormously kind of ambitious games filled with systems, filled with like side quests, and this is kind of what we've all demanded as gamers. We've demanded lots and lots and lots of content. Do you think it's like, I mean, what are rock, paper, shotgun readers like when they encounter these bugs? Do you get kind of lots of complaints from them, or is there a kind of understanding, well, this is maybe kind of what we've set up for ourselves?
I think it depends on the nature of the bug, for a start, because, I mean, at the beginning of this, you mentioned game-breaking bugs, and some of them seriously do break the game. I mean, I have a playthrough of Akami that I will never finish because an event never triggered and I can't leave an area, and so that game is completely broken to me now unless I start all over again and risk it happening again. And so to me, that was a hugely frustrating experience, and it means that I will probably never play that game despite it being, you know, hugely critically sort of acclaimed. Mm. But then there are other things that are just sort of quite entertaining, or, you know, like I was watching a YouTube video of the, you know, the people who just like turn up in the latest Assassin's Creed game, in Unity rather than Rogue, actually. And they just sort of start having like a conversation in the hallway while like an important sort of piece of plot exposition's going on. And, you know, to me, like, I mean, it would be irritating if I was trying to pay attention to the plot, but at the same time it's also quite entertaining, and so there's that sort of different nature of bugs. And sort of when I encounter stuff in, for example, you mentioned Fallout 3, I mean, I found myself getting a bit annoyed if it interfered with the flow of the game particularly, but at the same time I was very aware of the enormity of the experience. And so there are some things that I think are sort of more forgivable than others, and some things that are sort of more inconveniencing and less entertaining, and so on and so on. But I think that that comes through in QA reports as well. I think that there's like different levels of, you know, you cannot ship with this still like wrong with the game, and then like, you know, further down that you've got this is a real inconvenience and your player base will not be happy with you if this is still in the game, and then there's would be nice to fix if you have time, you will not have time because that's the nature of game development and crunch periods and stuff. And so, you know, there's those different sort of levels of trying to fix things and prioritizing as well. And yeah. So it was interesting you were saying about the games as services model as well, though, because so many times now you sort of encounter maybe a day one patch or something like that where you're sort of, you know, you're aware that there is still sort of work going on behind the scenes, and then games will be tweaked and tweaked as it goes, you know, because Destiny had a server update last night, and yeah. So I was sort of downloading that, looking through the notes and stuff, and it's, you know, tweaks to just various bits and bobs about the game, but it's clearly part of an ongoing process, you know, some bug fixes, some more sort of mechanical balancing things. So
I like the fact a night in for you involves reading through patch reports.
I also, for my leisure time, read through League of Legends tournament rule sets. So it's all go around mine.
But you actually mentioned something there which is really important, which is actually the comedy appeal of bugs, which does like happen. Like for example, I'm pretty sure that there was a boost in sales of the game Skate 3 recently because the very popular, enormously popular YouTube superstar PewDiePie has been making videos about Skate 3, which is Electronic Arts' skating simulation, because it's full of these bizarre physics quirks and lots of ridiculous things happen. And PewDiePie's made loads of videos about it, which are absolutely hilarious. Like, whatever you think of PewDiePie, his Skate 3 videos are great. It's just him careering into like park benches and flipping people off them, and his skateboard like shooting off into orbit. But that I'm sure there's been a boost in sales to that game after that. And I think, you know, the games have kind of taken on a life of their own where they have become kind of almost performance art as well as experiences. So some bugs are kind of part of the experience, a player-created experience.
Well, I think sometimes I feel a bit like if I was developing a game and I found a bug that made me laugh and didn't absolutely just mess up the game, I'd be tempted to maybe leave it in there and just see if other people found it, you know, more as a kind of almost an Easter egg, but just as a kind of piece of entertainment. And yeah, like you say, I think sometimes it doesn't necessarily hurt the game itself. It's more just sort of, I think it depends on what it does to the tone of the game as well. Like if it's a super serious kind of moment and there's it's not a bug, but the whole Jason business in Heavy Rain that actually sort of really disturbs the flow of it. So if, you know, for example, if that had just been a sort of a funny bug moment, then obviously that would have been very different.
It's the scene where he just continually shouts Jason to his son when he's lost him. Although there is a bug where he does that at the end of the game.
The
he won't stop doing
game.
It. And all the other characters, he's going for a cinematic scene. This is like a very dark psychological
and
thriller.
A really emotional sort of denouement, I guess.
Yeah. Throughout the entire cinematic ending sequence, the character just keeps repeating his son's voice over and over and again while all the other characters are going about their business trying to but it can sort of work out okay.
Michael, why don't you tell us about some of the bugs that you've had with Angelina? I'm guessing there have been some quite entertaining ones. I think, didn't she develop a crush on was it Obama?
It was Rupert Murdoch, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. So I should probably explain. Angelina is it's been my research for the last 4 years. A piece of software that can design very simple games on its own. But we tried to give it a bit of character, let it do things like learn about people on the internet, try to incorporate them into its games. But I mean, the more you use the internet, the weirder things get. So yeah, you're right. It did develop a crush on Rupert Murdoch. It used to read Twitter to find out what people thought of famous people. So it would look at Rupert Murdoch is, and then look at what words that followed the word is. And obviously, Rupert Murdoch is responsible for a lot of things, which people like to tweet about. But Angelina thought that Rupert Murdoch was responsible as a result of that. So responsible is obviously a very good trait. So Rupert Murdoch got very high marks, higher marks than, say, Bashar al-Assad when the Syria issue was going on. He scored way lower than Rupert Murdoch. But, I mean, Angelina's been a long series of bugs. But they're kind of embraced in academia. It's difficult. You can often find very emergent and interesting things from these kinds of things. You know, new things appear and they make you think about the software a little bit differently. You look at it from a different direction. And then sometimes you just get like a floating house that's the size of the entire level that floats past in the background, apropos of nothing, because Angelina just decided to put that in the background. It's not a problem.
Sounds like your approach to bugs is more sort of what I remember from science at school and at university, just sort of the idea of if the thing goes exactly to plan, that's kind of a bit boring and you don't get to actually dig into how something works, whereas the bits where it goes wrong are the bits where you actually start learning more. And so obviously it's very different from when you have an exact end product in mind that you desperately need to get out of the door by a certain date. But yeah, it sounds like the bugs are doing a very different thing for you.
Yeah, it's almost, I mean, we're very lucky in academia. So when we write grant proposals, we're not beholden to anyone at the end of it particularly. Obviously, they like us to spend the money on what we said we were going to spend it on. But there's a great line from Mark Riddell, who's a researcher over in America. And he says that the role of universities is to absorb risk. So I can take on projects that are bound to break. And when they break, it's kind of like you say, it's a sign that we were going in the right direction, because if they hadn't broken, we probably weren't being risky enough.
So, have you encountered any bizarre, interesting, hilarious bugs while you've been playing? If you have, then if you go to the Guardian website, go to the technology section, you will find, hopefully, there'll be a story there where I'm asking readers for their bug experiences. So go there and add to it. I have one, which I won't give away now, but it involves realistic breast physics. So you can read about that in the story. The PS4 and Xbox One consoles have now been out for a year, selling over 10 million units each and performing much better than their predecessors. On the Guardian website last week, I asked readers, what is the one new game feature you have seen on these platforms that really says next generation to you? The most popular answer by far was the Nemesis system in the role-playing game Middle-earth: Shadow of Mordor. In this brutal adventure, whenever you fight an enemy, they actually remember your meeting, leading to a range of emergent personal rivalries. So is it possible that the future of games is about intelligent characters and highly personal stories generated not by writers, but by the computers themselves? Michael, obviously Angelina is an artificial intelligence that writes games, but you've also recently hosted an event, haven't you, called Proc Jam. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so so if you've never come across a game jam before, the basic idea behind them is they're kind of like jamming in music. That was the original idea. So people would get together, they'd make some things which are a bit sketchy, a bit broken, and just the joy of making things together would be part of the attraction. And so game jams are typically where people make a game game in a certain period of time, about a theme. And I wanted to host an event where people really got into the idea of procedurally generating things. So our slogan was make something that makes something. So just anything that produced something else. And what that meant was that some people came at it from like the kind of classic game development, Shadows of Mordor, what can we generate kinds of stuff. And then at the other end, there were people making weird soundscapes and random deserts that mutated and horses that ran across them and neon colors. And it was an amazing event. It's just ended. We had over 130 submissions, which was brilliant. And it brought together lots of different groups as well. So we had researchers and their classes took part, but we also had artists. We had indie game studios took part in their entirety. Really, everyone got involved. And it's kind of a new community. It was really great.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a procedural content generation in a very basic form. Often in video games, tends to be landscapes. So you'll get games. The most famous example is Minecraft, which at the start of every game, when you start the game and load it up, it procedurally generates a landscape for you. So the programmer kind of provides an algorithm which tells the computer program roughly the sort of physical geometric parameters of what a world will look like. But then the computer generates the world itself based on those parameters. So procedural content generation is about the computer effectively making things itself based around a set series of rules. This we've seen in landscape for a very long time, but it seems to me that it started to slip into game narrative. Two games that spring to mind are Skyrim and Crusader Kings 2, both of which have used procedural elements to create kind of emergent mini tasks for players. So the games work out where the player is in the world, work out what they've done in the past, and from that kind of build a mini task or quest for them, which no one else will ever have had, based around, again, a set of criteria. So do you think this will be kind of where games are going in the future? Do you see this as a possibility for games?
Definitely. I think what's interesting with procedural generation lately is we used to think of it as something that could generate quite static and generic kinds of content, like the world in Minecraft. It's not really, I mean, it's central to the game, but it doesn't affect you. You're not surprised by each world that you see. It's kind of the same world. And then over time, we've kind of realized, well, procedural generators take the place of a human, in a sense. They're taking the place of the level designer in Minecraft. And actually, we can replace almost any aspect of game design by a system if we wanted to, if we worked hard enough at it, maybe. And that opens up some really exciting opportunities to have a game designer in the living room with you while you're playing this game. It means that games can be surprising and novel and innovative in ways that they never were before. And narrative is a really powerful way to start affecting it, because people get so attached to these stories, like you say. And I think we were talking about YouTubers and people like PewDiePie earlier. And when people feel a connection to a personality, to see that personality experiencing their own story, it strengthens the sense of community. And that community can be, you know, a million people in the case of a YouTube channel, or it can be the six people that you talk about your game at school with. And I just think there's so much untapped potential in procedural generation. The Jam had entries ranging from a quilt generator all the way through to really beautiful procedural flowers that would grow depending on where they were in the world, and you could feed them different nutrients to make them grow differently. And I mean, these are crazy stuff. These aren't like hunting down orcs and the kinds of AAA blockbuster stuff that you think of, but it just shows you the variety of things that we've never tried before, I think. And that that's what's really exciting to me, is what is potentially out there. And narratives are the top of the list, I think, for a lot of people. I'm seeing a lot more research and a lot more experimentation in indies to do with that kind of thing too.
Harvey, I was going to ask you, like, one of the big problems, I guess, with procedural generation and relying too much on artificial intelligence in very big games is that it must be kind of worrying if you were talking about how someone at the end of the day has got to pay for Assassin's Creed to be made, and just as an example. And will those people, you know, who's, you know, the investors, when they're sitting around a table and they're told, actually, well, this game is going to be almost entirely procedurally generated, so we can't tell you what the story is, we can't tell you what the plot is, we can't tell you what's going to happen to the gamers, because it's all going to be made up by the computer. That would be a terrifying prospect, wouldn't it, for a large studio?
I think if it was to, we're just going to trust the system to come up with the entire game, beginning to end, it's okay, give us a bit of money and we'll make, yeah, that's quite scary. But you know, as you were talking, Michael, I was realizing that we've talked about behaviors in AI in games for years. I mean, you know, at least a decade, probably longer. And we used to talk about, you know, trigger events. So this thing happens, then X will happen. And this thing happens, then Y will happen. And actually now we don't. What we try and do is we set up the behaviors that we expect, whatever the thing or object is, and that's what it has to behave and do. And that should then trigger the right kind of dialogue or the right kind of action or the right kind of reaction. And we actually have been doing that in games as an industry for a long, long time. I think what we're finding with the next gen, this sort of new generation, is we can give that a bit more processing power and we can afford a little bit more latitude. And yeah, I don't think we're quite ready to trust mainstream games, indie community, absolutely, because they're much braver than the big guys with a huge budget behind them, but also a huge responsibility. Indie guys kind of just go for it. But I think we can start to allow behaviors to have a bit more latitude and a bit more space and see emergent behavior. And we used to describe that as sort of just unintended features rather than bugs or bad things. They're unintended features. They're just things you didn't know you designed into your game.
There was an interesting thing you said earlier, Keith, about all of these bugs in Assassin's Creed being our fault as gamers because we were asking for too much. But I think there's a difference between ambition and entitlement. And I think actually we're not ambitious enough. And I think the listeners to this podcast need to be more demanding, not less. Like, they have to force developers at every scale to kind of reach for the moon a bit more and go to that crazy next step, because that's where you find the exciting bugs that teach you more about the future.
So yeah, on that subject, it's really interesting that we're getting lots of space games coming out. Elite Dangerous, Destiny's just come out, Star Citizen's coming out next year. There's some very big games with kind of big budgets behind them, but the game that it seems to me that most people are looking forward to in this space is No Man's Sky, which is a game which has been made by seven people in a tiny office in Guildford for you know, pocket change compared to I suspect what Destiny is apparently has apparently costed. And this is because it's a game where it's totally open. It's in a procedurally generated universe. Whenever you land on a planet in No Man's Sky, which is kind of a space exploration game, whenever you land on a planet, the planet is generated from, again, a set of algorithms. You don't know what's going to be there. You don't know what flora is going to be there, what fauna. There could be dinosaurs. There could be monsters. You just don't know. So for every player, the exploration system is, you know, is very different. So it seems to me that there is a kind of a profound desire for very different, weird, offbeat experiences within the games community. But I think actually they maybe just don't have the confidence to ask for it. Like, No Man's Sky has come along not because there was hundreds and hundreds of people on Rock Paper Shotgun asking for it. It came along because they were inspired to do it. I think that's you know, maybe difficult for AAAs to just pick out inspiration like that and really go with it and really allow a system to lead them in unusual ways.
No, I totally agree. It's actually very difficult to think of these things. And I think to many people, procedural generation was just, like you say, it's Minecraft.
Well, I have a question. As part of the game jam, did anybody create anything that procedurally generated the control system?
No. And actually, so way, way back 4 years ago, when I was just starting Angelina, I sat on a train and I was like, okay, how do you design games automatically? And the first thing I did was procedurally generate a control system for a game. And it was the worst thing I've ever done. That's really interesting because that came up recently at an event I was at, and I think it's one of the most human aspects of game design. I think we'll be covering another one later in the podcast probably, but there's a lot of things about feel and about how nice that feels to the person playing it. I'd be very interested to look at that with like biofeedback and things like that to try and read how you're getting on with this control scheme right now, but it's certainly very tricky.
Yeah. Well, some biofeedback stuff actually does sort of generate the content and sort of like audit what your experience is. I know that Erin Reynolds, I think, is working on Nevermind, which tracks your heart rate and then alters the difficulty of the game based on how stressed you are by it. Like, it's sort of a horror game thing, and the idea is that you develop ways to deal with that stress and bring the difficulty back down. But yeah, it's an interesting kind of application of those kinds of ways of thinking about things.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
Announced last year, and a heart-wrenching highlight of many games events since then, That Dragon Cancer is a highly personal game drawn from the devastating experience of Ryan and Amy Green, whose son Joel was diagnosed with terminal cancer aged only one. Joel fought for survival for another 3 years, confounding medical expectations before passing away last March.
He won't stop crying. I don't blame him. He feels miserable. I hate that we're here. I hate that he's sick. I just want him to feel better.
The game puts players into the role of Joel's parents, experiencing the cancer diagnosis and the terrifying yet humane experience of helping a very young child fight a terminal disease. Set for release next year on PC, Mac and the Ouya console, That Dragon Cancer is a week into what will hopefully be a successful Kickstarter funding campaign. To find out more, I spoke to Ryan Green, father of Joel and co-creator of That Dragon Cancer.
It's about our family's experience raising our son Joel, who battled terminal brain cancer for 4 years. You explore a 3D environment to kind of unlock the story, and along the way, there's various interactions, and really the focus is kind of just being present in the moment. Really focus on, you know, what it was like to love Joel and spend time with Joel and interact with him. And also you kind of get to experience or relive some of those harder moments, but also some of the sweeter moments of our life and things that we struggle with, the way that we struggle with our faith, the way that we struggle with love and loss and fear.
Because I think it's kind of important to you, it seems, from the last time I spoke to you, and I spoke to you and Josh a while ago, and you said that you don't want the game to be kind of an entirely, so you don't want the game to be a negative experience. You don't want it to be something that people dread, because the time you had with Joel was really special. And you want to convey that as well, don't you? The fact that there was great joy in his life as well.
So yeah, that's very important to me. I think that there's a tendency to fear. I mean, let's be honest, like, that's losing your children as a parent's, you know, greatest fear, and it's warranted. It's a scary thing, and it's a horrible thing. But I think that it's just it's important to me that people not be afraid of what we're making. There are going to be hard things, and there are going to be devastating things. However, I also wanted to put in Joel's favorite things, and I think that anybody can relate to that. And hopefully, you know, I've said over and over again, I feel like our experience in battling cancer and losing Joel is a very personal experience. I can't tell anybody I know how you feel. You know, I only know how I feel. But I know that the experience is universal, and I hope that people can find comfort, and I hope that people can find that it affords people the ability to grieve well.
So the game is in Kickstarter at the moment, and it seems to be doing really well. It's only been on Kickstarter for a week, and you're over halfway to your target. But there's in the introduction text to the Kickstarter, there's a really lovely description of the game, which is it's a video game developer's love letter to his son, an adventure game to inspire us to love each other, a voice for those fighting cancer. And I just wanted to, on the last point, I just wondered if you'd had any feedback from people who maybe are in a similar position to you and your family, or have loved ones that are in who are fighting cancer, who have played That Dragon Cancer and have found something in it. Have you had any sort of feedback from people in that situation?
Yeah, one thing that really encouraged us from the very beginning is that, you know, when we shared, when I shared my heart with them through this video game, their inclination was to share their heart with us. And so a lot of times, you know, the first thing that we talked about is, you know, a loss that they had in their life, or you know, an experience that they went through that was similar. And so I found that it's a very amazing way for us as strangers and new friends to talk about hard things. I think what's been encouraging to me about our Kickstarter is that, you know, one thing that we wanted to do back in PAX, we decided to do a fundraiser. And part of the fundraiser was that we solicited art from people in the community. And we said, make art about the day that you faced that dragon. And what was cool is we had a bunch of artists contribute their work. And so then we printed out their work. And then for donations to Extra Life and the Children's Hospital, we gave out a poster with our story on the back. And that was kind of the seed of the idea of, like, you know, suddenly we're like, oh, we've been given this platform, and this is the platform that we get to tell our story on. There should be space to tell other people's stories. And so when we added that to the Kickstarter, we made space in the game for people to contribute their art and put it in the walls of the hospital, as well as even handprints or footprints. We're asking that the people at the, that pledge for that this images with hand ink hand or footprints so that we can place them on the wall of the hospital. And so we thought, oh, this might be interesting. Hopefully people will support that. And we've just been overwhelmed by the amount of interest there has been in that. There's been so many people that have pledged at those levels and want to contribute their story. And I just love the private messages that we're getting where people tell us just really amazing, beautiful stories about people that they've lost and memories that they've had and that they believe in what we're doing and that they're willing to add their voice to what we're doing. That was, you know, that's always been a concern as we've gone through this is that, you know, I don't want people to, you know, maybe their views on video games is that it's something that is a pastime or something that that would somehow diminish the experience. And I'm glad that they're understanding what we're doing and why we're doing it, and that they're willing to add their voice to it. I just think that's really special. So I've been really encouraged by that, and I've been overwhelmed by the positive response that we've received through the Kickstarter.
So that was Ryan Green about his game, That Dragon Cancer. And it was interesting, one of the things he said there about the way that people have kind of interacted with the game so far. Because I definitely, when I was at Rezzed, you see people making passes past the monitor. You know, the people will go past, have a look. They'll come back, maybe watch someone else play for a bit, go away, come back, maybe have a little bit of a go themselves. It's a game where people almost have to kind of instill in themselves the strength to face it, which is often that happens with games because they're scary or they're violent, but very rarely because they're, well, almost never because they're, it's an emotional experience, isn't it?
I think it's a difficult game to approach within the context of a games expo, because I know that you played it at Rezzed, and sort of in a hall that is full of, you know, a lot of sort of flashing lights and, you know, different types of, you know, like fast-paced action kind of shootery kind of things, asking people to connect with something so emotionally sort of involved and challenging, it is a big ask, and it involves making yourself vulnerable in public as well. You know, sort of, I know that a fair few people have sort of cried after playing it, and just sort of doing that in a public space is quite daunting. So I think, yeah, it's quite a challenging experience to put in front of people and sort of for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
Its booths always have this amazing air. You know, normally at a conference like that, any kind of event, you see a game, the developers are kind of over your shoulder talking to you about it while you're playing it, and there's a crowd of people waiting to go on it, and everyone kind of gives That Dragon Cancer this kind of respectful distance. They just let the player play, and, you know, even if they want to play, they kind of just sometimes just stand at a completely different booth and just eye it every now and again. It's almost like a ritual that they're letting other people experience.
Yeah, I mean, what fascinates me about the project is that, you know, it deals with lots of taboos and worries that we all have. I mean, cancer is a massive taboo. It's very difficult to talk about it. And my father died of cancer 10 years ago, and it was really difficult. Maybe it's a male thing, but I found I had very little way to talk to people about it, and it's very difficult. And people didn't want to really talk about it because it's this, you know, enormous fear. It affects, you know, one in four of us in our lifetimes, and it's this subject that terrifies us. And also now wrapped in it, obviously, because Joel passed away this year, is the spectre of death as well. And, you know, these are big taboo subjects that we find it very difficult to face. And, you know, maybe some ways video games are a good way of exploring that, because they give us some sense of control, whereas a film is an experience which is put in front of us and which we either feel sad at or we reject as someone else's, whatever it is, it's someone else's story. Whereas with that Dragon Cancer, it puts you right into the story and gives you kind of, even if it's an illusion, it's a sense of control which no other medium can really do.
It's strange that you say that, because when I was playing the press demo, I think it's different to the one that you played, actually, but one of the things that really stuck out to me was the complete lack of control. You know, you could sort of interact with elements of the environment, but ultimately it didn't help, or it didn't change things, or it didn't change what people were saying to you. And so, you know, I think that was an interesting sort of subversion of how video games work. And
yeah.
I guess sort of putting it in that way sounds like I'm massively making a subject academic, but it's when you're sort of playing it, you do start to suddenly go, wait, I don't have any control over this thing right now. And that is terrifying to me.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, exactly. And I suppose that, you know, that's what I said about the scene in the ICU when I was talking to Ryan, is the fact that, you know, it gives you these kind of foibles of an adventure convention, like and it allows you to try the door, and it allows you to try and give a drink to Joel while he's in his cot crying. But I guess maybe what I mean by control is that sense of inhabiting the world in a, and I don't know why that should be reassuring, but it's a way of kind of investigating and exploring your feelings, the feelings you may have had, which I don't, in a way that I don't think a film provides.
I think there are a lot of things that can only be expressed through systems. Anna Anthropy's got that great definition of games as an experience defined by rules. And I think one of the things that stands out for me about that Dragon Cancer is the feeling of waiting, which is a big thing for anyone who's been in a hospital. And I think to properly convey that, you need to give people, like you say, control over the systems, or lack of control, which, you know, but there are some things which I think are difficult to convey through any other medium.
Yeah.
But it is interesting when you talk about voluntarily exposing yourself to a negative experience. I mean, I don't think many people think that games just have to be fun, but there's a difference between, say, playing a horror game and really exposing yourself to something as raw as this. It's a very unusual but very interesting project.
Well, yeah. Touching on something that Ryan said, there are a lot of people who sort of have a fear of engaging with it, and there were also a lot of comments that I saw on articles about the game saying, I am so glad this game exists, I will never play it. And so that was actually really interesting, just in terms of perhaps it's just a good thing that this game exists out there and people know that it does. And that in itself performs a function, you know, that games can do that and I don't have to be anywhere near it because I'm terrified, or, you know, and it's okay to be absolutely terrified and not want to.
Yeah, yeah, I definitely. Yeah, but I think also within it is the kernel of the idea that games can be used as a form of self-expression as well. So beyond playing, the fact that, you know, you mentioned Anna Anthropy, and who made a really interesting game called Dysphoria, about transgender transition, and that, you know, it's something I know absolutely nothing about, and I don't, you know, I don't have kind of the emotive bandwidth to understand what she went through, but yet there in that experience, it's a very simple game, but it allowed me to understand that process. And also Depression Crest by Zoe Quinn, which is very simplified. And Zoe Quinn was very interesting in the way she talks about Depression Crest, which is a game about you play a character who's dealing with depression, who's looking for medication, looking for therapy. And it's really interesting that she said her brain kind of tends to think about things as systems, and emotions as systems. And depression itself is a kind of, you know, horrible, dark system. So I think games have that, don't they? Games have that ability to portray the fact that we are kind of, that this is how we work, that we are emotional beings, but everything, you know, our way of structuring and ordering our lives is systemic in a way.
So the reason I find this self-expression question interesting is because I often frame myself as being someone who writes software to do things that we think only humans can do, like paint paintings and compose beautiful music. But Angelina will never communicate with players in the way that Dragon Cancer does, or that Ryan does, no matter how amazing it becomes at game design, because it's not a human being. And there's something very special about understanding Ryan and understanding the common human condition when we play games like that. And I know that sounds fairly out there. It's not why we typically sit down to play something like Destiny that we talked about this episode, but that fascinates me because we'll never come close to that in our research field, and I think that's amazing. Like, I like having that little space there that we'll never touch.
A huge thank you then to all my guests this week, Philippa Waugh, Michael Cook, Harvey Elliott and Ryan Green. For links to that Dragon Cancer and all the games we mentioned on the show today, just go to the blog for this edition of the podcast at theguardian.com/audio. So from me, Keith Stewart, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, we'll be back next Wednesday. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.